It's Wrestling Observer Live, 7 days a week. Monday through Friday, 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific. Sundays, Andrew Zarian is back, 6 p.m. Eastern, 3 Pacific. And Saturdays, 1 p.m. Eastern, 10 a.m. Pacific. It's Jim Valley.
Thicker than a Snickers.
The effing king of recovery.
Faster than a cat with whiskers.
Back. Because of the fans.
Each and every one of you.
The largest gathering of trailer park trash.
You all fat, neck, beard, and mouth breathing trolls.
They don't have adrenaline in their soul.
So I am not live today. Sadly, I'm at the funeral for my first grade teacher, a very, very nice, intelligent, and kind man who meant a lot to me. Also, I will not be here next week. I'm going to go in search of snow. Want to see some snow. Seeing all these people over the holidays that had snow made me very jealous. But I'm not leaving you in the lurch either this week or next week. I have got a treat for you. A conversation. We'll do two parts this week and next week with longtime fan, historian, author, agent, and more, Evan Ginsberg. He was a technical producer on the Mickey Rourke movie, The Wrestler. He's got a ton of stories, and he can talk about the history that he witnessed firsthand. Also, his new book is coming out, or is it is out. Wrestling Rings, Blackboards, and Movie Sets, which you can find on Amazon. Collision is tonight. It's a fun show, kind of chaotic, which fits for maximum carnage. It's a very violent and bloody Texas death match with Adam Page and Christopher Daniels, the 12-man tag to end the show, and lots of things in between to set up Dynamite in Knoxville and Collision at Daly's Place in Jacksonville next week. So, not like the greatest show ever, but definitely a lot of things happening to keep you entertained. Today and next week, I hope to keep you entertained. I expected to only talk to Evan Ginsberg for one show's worth of things, and we talked for over an hour and a half. So, I thoroughly enjoyed it. I hope you do too. If you love history or want to learn about history, this, my friends, is the show for you. So coming up next, we'll chat with Evan Ginsberg. It's Jim Valley, Wrestling Observer Live. It's Jim Valley. It's Wrestling Observer Live. Very special show today. Evan Ginsberg, who has a brand new book out. You can get it on Amazon. Wrestling Rings, Blackboards, and Movie Sets. His experiences with over 50 years watching and being a part of professional wrestling. So, Evan, how long have you been a fan or watched wrestling?
I have been a fan since 1972. And I tell this story in my book. I was home in East Flatbush, Brooklyn, a rainy, nasty day. And I was a kid. I was bored out of my mind. And I discover the UHF dial. I just discover it because I'm bored. And I'm checking out all the channels. And they have all these PBS channels and foreign language channels. And all of a sudden, I see this monstrous guy pounding on this Indian. And I didn't even know what it was. It was wrestling. It was WWF, and Chief J Strongbow was getting pounded. And I'm a kid. I think it's real.
Right.
And all of a sudden, Strongbow makes this herky-jerky war dance comeback, you know, 10 years before Hulk Hogan's comebacks or whatnot. And I'm marking out. I'm like, wow, this is great. What is it? And I realized it was wrestling, pro wrestling, and I figured out, oh, it's at this time, this channel hidden on the UHF dial. It wasn't mainstream yet, and I would watch it religiously, and finally I begged my dad, who was a New York City taxi driver who never broke 25 grand, Dad, please take me to wrestling. So the first card was at Madison Square Garden. I could tell you the date. It's so etched in my memory. June 24th, 1974. And the main event is Nikolai Volkov, who used to squeeze an apple and it would explode in his bare hands. That's how powerful he was. With Fred Blassie, who was the most charismatic heel you'd ever see, every hair in place. He looked like a movie star, against Bruno and Chief J Strongbow. And I walked into the Garden that night as a kid, 14 or so, and my first reaction, I'll never forget, I was like, wow, this is in color, because we had a black and white TV back then. It's in color. It was like walking into Oz, like when Dorothy lands in Oz. That's how I felt.
Right.
And it was magic. The Valiant Brothers wrestled Dean Ho and Tony Garea that night. And there was Black Gordman, who I was watching on the LA TV tapings in New York by that point. Pedro Morales. And, you know, there was no pyro. There was no entrance themes. Just the sheer charisma. Bruno would walk down the aisle in a pair of tights and the building would shake. The building would literally shake. And the only way to explain it, because a lot of the younger fans would go, oh, they just punched and kicked. You know, I don't get it. What's this all about with Bruno and Pedro and Strongbow? And I was like, you don't understand the charisma. And you also don't understand the psychology of that crowd. It was a blue-collar mock crowd. Most of us believed. We thought it was real. My father, who would take me, was a World War II veteran. So do the math. This is only 30 years or so later, and there's Waldo von Erich. There's Baron von Raschke playing Nazi heels. And, you know, every time they hit Bruno or Pedro, we felt it. We thought it was real. And it was magic. It was like Marvel superheroes and villains come to life. And I've loved it ever since.
How many shows do you think you saw or have seen at the Garden?
I went pretty much every month from June 74 until 1985. Pretty much every month. So right there, you know, it's a couple of hundred. And after the fact, I loved heel Piper circa 84, 85, Piper and Bob Orton, Cowboy Bob Orton, Slaughter and Sheik, Superfly and Piper, Superfly and Morocco, you know. But once Vince went full kiddie show, full circus by the late 80s, early 90s, I was done. I was going to NWA shows in Philly and Pro Wrestling USA, AWA, and NWA combo shows, TWA, Joe Goodhart in Phily, except ECW in the 90s, etc. I pretty much, it was very rare for me to go to a WWE show. It had to be something very special. Yeah, I really kind of lost my taste for them.
You know, it's very funny. I don't know, funny, but, you know, today, the kids who were enthralled by that Hulkamania era, you know, they're somewhere plus or minus 40-some years old. And sometimes they will chastise me because, you know, they see that Hulkamania era as old school.
Yeah.
And the fans like yourself who were around then, who were previous fans, the ones who were either pushed out from their tickets or turned off like you. You know, Bruno would say things negatively about the Hogan era. Other people would, Luthez famously and others. And it's just funny how now, you know, with the passage of time, that era, that kiddie era, which made millions and millions and millions of dollars, is now seen as old school.
Yeah. Well, it's what you go back to as a kid, if that's when they were a kid.
Right.
I was associate producer on The Wrestler, and Aronofsky and Scott Franklin, the executive producer, the money guy. I mean, that was the era that they went to wrestling, and that, you know, drew them in. So if it wasn't for that era, you probably wouldn't have the Wrestler film. So, yeah, I mean, what happened was in 84, 85, it was like a transitional period. And, you know, Piper would blow the roof off the Garden. And it was some of the greatest, you know, wrestling I ever saw. I tell people, heel Piper, that era, he would come into the ring with or without Orton, so singles or tag team. And it was absolute chaos. I mean, it was brawling, blood, chairs, fighting outside the ring, you know, through the crowd. It was crazy. And after it was all over, you could breathe again. You could breathe again. That's how exciting, you know, heel Piper was. And,
well, you know, being from a small town halfway between Seattle and Portland, so I grew up with Don Owen.
Don Owen.
Right. Yeah. So I, you know, I wouldn't be sitting here probably if it wasn't for Roddy Piper.
Piper would be on any old school fan's Mount Rushmore of great heels. Yeah. I didn't like him as much as a face in WWF, but as a heel, he was unbelievable. And
yeah, well,
I tell people some of the greatest nights of my life. And I also tell people what you have to understand about old school fans, sitting there with our dads, moms, grandparents, aunts, uncles, decades later, they're gone. And you look at those nights as some of the most meaningful, beautiful nights because you spent it with your family and shared these experiences with your family. My dad died when I was 20. So, you know, when I look back at going to WWF, I'm like, you know, those were some of the best nights of my life. I shared it with him, and it becomes that much more meaningful.
We're talking with Evan Ginsberg, longtime fan who has worked in many facets of professional wrestling for over 50 years. New book, Wrestling Rings, Blackboards, and Movie Sets, available now on Amazon. Stand by. More with Evan Ginsberg next. Jim Valley, Wrestling Observer Live. Jim Valley, Wrestling Observer Live with Evan Ginsberg. What were the crowds like when you went to the Garden?
In WWF and later WWF, it was a blue-collar crowd,
right,
that... And they purposely appealed to different ethnic groups. There was a huge Puerto Rican population in New York. So you had Pedro Morales as the world champion, as the two-time intercontinental champion. You had the Polish strongman, Ivan Putski. You had the Italian Superman, Bruno Sammartino, you know, et cetera, so on. And, you know, they drew people. It was blue. My grandfather was a butcher. He loved wrestling. You know, it's in my DNA. My father was a taxi driver, you know, et cetera, so on. And, you know, now the last Garden Card, 2024 in December, tickets were $63 to $1,011, okay? And I've seen one person after another saying, it's heartbreaking to me. I have to tell my kids I can't afford to take you.
Yeah.
And ironically, you know, the WWE spin is every show is a sellout. No, they drew 11,000, which would have been a minuscule crowd back in the 70s and 80s.
Yeah.
And back in those days, they ran 12 to 14 cards a year. Okay. and it was packed. Now they run 3, 4, 5 cards a year at the Garden, and was only half full. So it says something about the all-encompassing greed. Greed.
It's an issue that all live events have.
WrestleMania is 450 to 10,000 a ticket. 10,000, yeah, with $50,000 VIP packages.
Yeah.
So inevitably, people go, I just don't have the money.
Even if I had that kind of cash laying around, I don't think I would do it because I don't think I would get that kind of enjoyment out of it. I mean, I like wrestling. One of the things that appeals to me is I like that populist entertainment. You can turn it on, and anybody from around the world can watch it and understand.
My radio mentor, Fred Geobold, over at WBAI-FM in New York City, where we ran for 16 years, he said pro wrestling was the proletarian performance art.
Yes.
Theater for the people.
Yes.
You know? And, you know, very, like you said, a very simple, you know, good guy, bad guy, what are they fighting over? And he was weaned on AWA. He was from the Midwest, and, you know, he loved the Crusher and the Bruiser. And,
sure.
You know, it was very simple. He's the good guy, he's the bad guy. And you loved it because of that. And now, what I tell people, my best buddy's nephew, we ironically have the same birthday, me and his nephew. We took him and his buddies to Ring of Honor and to indie shows throughout their childhood because that was affordable. And even now, you could go to an indie show for $15-$20, meet the wrestlers, take pictures. So my mantra has always been support indie everything.
Yeah.
Support indie wrestling, indie publishing, indie filmmaking, indie music. I have tons of brilliant indie musician friends. As someone older, I just cringe when people do the, there's been no good music since the Beatles.
Right.
You know, no, there's been no good music in 50 years. That's ridiculous.
Right.
So support indie everything. You meet the performers, they're grateful to you, you take pictures, you get autographs, you're not sitting, you know, a mile away. I was also a big Knicks fan, New York Knicks in New York during the glory years, 69 and 73 with my dad. And when they were in the playoffs last year, it was $330 on top in the nosebleeds. So, you know, it's like, it's just not affordable for a lot of people. And, you know, support indie everything. You'll have a better experience.
Two things that drive me crazy. Like, everybody got the same idea. Let's cater to rich people. Everybody did. You know, sports, theme parks, everything. And the other aspect is when wrestling fans say, oh, so-and-so can't be any good because they're not or have never been in WWE.
I love Lucha. I've been to Mexico, Auditorio de Tijuana. I saw Rey Mysterio there when he was a teenager.
Right.
I'm not one of these old school fans who, you know, similarly to the music fans. I do not, there's been no good wrestling since the territories. That's nonsense.
I know.
I love Ospreay. I love Omega.
Yeah.
I love Okada, you know, Swerve. In WWE, Gunther's old school. The guy's tremendous.
Yeah.
Tremendous. I like Cody. Reigns on the right night when it's, you know, not all shtick and entrance. You know, when he's in wrestling mode, Reigns could put on a great match.
Yeah.
I just want to see great wrestling. You know, in WWE, when you have a three-hour roar and there's 50 minutes of wrestling, that's not for me. I'd rather go to the gym or watch a great film instead. It's just not a great investment of my time, but I still watch WWE pay-per-views, premium live events, whatever you want to call it. And let me put this out there. I hope you don't mind. You can edit it out if you do. But I agree with what a lot of Dave Meltzer says. I like AEW. I love Ospreay and Omega. I thought Omega and Okada had some of the greatest matches in the history of the business.
I agree.
So when they do the, oh, he only likes AEW, he only likes Japan, that's not true. It's not,
I know.
And also, let me say this. Sometimes I won't agree with some of Dave's ratings. And so what? It's like watching a movie.
Right.
Two different critics have a different reaction to it. It doesn't make the guy your enemy. I don't understand, you know, the hostility towards him. He's only telling you what he enjoys and appreciates, and I have similar tastes.
Well, it is what he likes and appreciates, but it's also from an educated point of view, an experienced point of view, but also it's profitable and lucrative to rip on Dave.
I mean, if Dave thinks the match is 5 stars and some kid thinks it's 4 stars, it doesn't make him their mortal enemy to begin with. It's ridiculous.
I know, it is. I agree. So when did you sort of transition from just a fan in the stands to having various relationships and various jobs or things in wrestling?
What I have found is one thing always leads to another. It's like you're opening doors. In 1990, I was out of work. I had taught kids previously. I was a Common Branch N through 6 school teacher, and I did not like teaching kids. So I'm out of work, and I start a sheet. It was called Wrestling Then and Now, and it ran for a good 20 years. Killer Kowalski was a columnist. So that led to a radio gig, like I said, on 50,000 watt WBAI in New York. I was offered to do a wrestling segment, not a wrestling show, a wrestling segment on an arts program because the host just happened to love wrestling. So that led to me meeting tons of legendary wrestlers. We were 50,000 watt New York station. So I became an agent, and I started booking guys like Johnny Valiant, Jimmy Valiant, Nikolai, which was surreal because these were my childhood heroes. And, you know, we'd be on the road, and there's Johnny sleeping on my couch. I'm rooming with Nikolai on the road doing autograph appearances. So Nikolai would wake up like 6 in the morning. He had these hand-carved blocks from the old country that he made. Okay, he'd do 300 push-ups to start his day. So one morning he gets his look. He goes, "Evan, let's arm wrestle." And I go, "Okay." And I'm 6'2", you know, 205. I'm not a 98-pound weakling. I go to the gym. So I'm arm wrestling this guy. I couldn't move him 1 inch, not 1 inch. That's how, and he wasn't a kid then, you know, powerful guy. And you know, that led to one of the greatest experiences of my life. I had Johnny Valiant and Nikolai booked for an autograph appearance. And all of a sudden, this, you know, well-spoken gentleman approaches me and he says to me, "I'm Scott Franklin, film producer's oldest friend, and they're working on a wrestling film, Darren Aronofsky." Scott Franklin's working with Darren Aronofsky. And he says, quote, "You guys would be perfect for this." And, you know, I hand them a business card and, you know, I don't hear from them for months. And I kind of, you know, almost forget about it. And all of a sudden I get a call from Darren Aronofsky's office, Protozoa Studios in Brooklyn. And next thing I know, we're having a meeting. And I bring to this meeting, I'll never forget it, Nikolai, who's gone, Johnny, who's gone, Tiger Khan, who worked for the Hearts in Calgary, he's gone. Nikita Brezhnikov, who was Nikolai's shoot manager and the indie heel manager, and myself. And Johnny was one of the funniest guys on the planet. He did stand-up comedy. And Nikolai was one of the warmest. When Nikolai died, Bret Hart said, quote, "Nikolai Volkoff was the nicest wrestler I've ever met." And Bret Hart met everybody. So basically, they were just charmed. They were laughing for hours. They were telling road stories. And again, months went by after that meeting, and all of a sudden, I get a call from Scott Franklin, the executive producer. People get confused with the titles. Executive producer is the money guy. I was the associate producer. I was the wrestling guy. It's a big difference. I didn't finance the film. So he offers me the job. He says, "Evan, you know, you're the right guy for this. You have the contacts." And I did. I was an agent. And I would bring these guys to all kinds of, you know, signings, private parties, whatever it may be.
It's Jim Valley with Evan Ginsberg. We'll talk about more details about the wrestler, including how long it took to get it made. Stand by, Jim Valley, Wrestling Observer Live. Jim Valley, Wrestling Observer Live with Evan Ginsberg. And you were saying it took a very long time to finally get the movie made.
The process was 7 years. 7 years from the time we met to getting the funding. And I was sitting at the funding meetings and, you know, 5 or 6 script revisions. And the shooting itself was just 5 7-day weeks, 35 days. But it was a 7-year process. People have no idea what goes into making a movie. And, you know, I'm happy to answer any questions about The Wrestler or whatnot. But that was kind of the progression. I went from sheet editor to radio guy to agent. Later, I did internet radio and TV as well. And, you know, and that got me into films. I've done multiple films and, you know, books, of course, also.
Right. You know, one of the things I remember about The Wrestler was so many guys in their shoot interviews talking about, oh, The Wrestler, it makes all the wrestlers look bad. Da 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 da. And I never took it as a broad criticism of what happens to wrestlers after wrestling. I took it as, I mean, we've seen guys in any industry, once they retire from something, who can be down on their luck. I didn't take it as a broad criticism of every wrestler ever. But I do remember so many interviews about the scene with the convention and the empty convention.
And well, let me tell you the backstory.
I'm going to get to that because I've heard you tell this. Because you told this the other night at an audio on a video stream. But anybody, like you said, who's been to indie shows or indie events or anything outside, well, hell, even there are times that the new fans don't understand. Even there have been times when WWE didn't draw, when Raw was in high school gyms. Wrestling has its ebbs and flows. And, you know, I hope it never ebbs again. But inevitably, when it does, it's going to blow these new fans' minds. But if you've been around for any amount of time, you've seen this. And it just always pissed me off that these wrestlers would say, oh, that's never happened. And I was like, the hell it hasn't. And as you said, it's based on a real life event.
I was taking Aronofsky and Scott Franklin and Robert Siegel, the screenwriter, and other crew members to different wrestling events for 6 months prior to shooting. To Aronofsky's credit, he wanted it to ring true. So I take them to this convention in Jersey, and it was like the WWE Hall of Fame. Moolah, Mae Young, Tony Atlas, Johnny Valiant, Sheik, Nikolai, et cetera, so on. It was, but there was nobody there. There were a couple dozen people. It was empty, empty. And Aronofsky, who's a good guy, his mom was a school teacher. He's not a rich kid born with a silver spoon. He made it on talent and drive. Aronofsky kept saying to me, Evan, where is everybody? And he was saddened by it. We all were. And it was so bad, Iron Sheik's head was down on the table asleep. That's how quiet this convention was. And I wasn't writing, but I was helping the screenwriter as he was doing various revisions, telling him what rang true, what didn't, as far as the wrestling. So, for example, early on in the process, one of the earliest scripts, he had Randy the Ram blading, and everybody's watching. And I said, nobody would be watching. It's just another day at the office. Nobody would care. So they took that out of the screenplay. So after that sad convention, Rob added that scene to the screenplay. And it's a powerful scene.
Yeah.
And let me just say this. The only actual wrestlers in that scene when we filmed it was Manny Yarborough, who was a black sumo. He was a friend of mine, 800 pounds. He's gone now. And Johnny Valiant was recreating the Iron Sheik moment. His head was down on the table asleep. Everybody else were extras. And I was hawking Darren for months. I said, Darren, for that scene, we could get, you know, Lou Albano and Sheik and Nikolai and everybody, they would do it. And he was debating. And finally he says, Evan, I don't want Mickey to look like the what's wrong with this picture. I don't want him to look like odd man out. And that was his final decision. And what I learned from the process was Darren looked at things cinematically. I looked at things as a wrestling guy. Like I was saying, bring in Nigel McGuinness, who at that point was, you know, one of the best, if not the best in the world. I said, bring in Nigel McGuinness for a big part in there. And he felt Romeo Roselli looked more cinematic because Romeo Roselli looked like a Greek god, you know. So, you know, and there were points I said, bring in Teddy the Tank Reed, who was Cassius in WCW's, you know, No Limit Soldiers, big monstrous guy, yeah, lovable guy in real life, a friend of mine.
I remember him. Yeah.
But again, Aronofsky goes, he would make Mickey look tiny. I don't want it. And the reverse, I said, bring in lowlife Louis Ramos for the hardcore scene. He's a very charismatic hardcore wrestler. And he met with Darren, and Darren went, Louis's too small. Okay, and he ended up going with Necro Butcher, who was amazing. But I'm just saying it was an interesting experience. But the most interesting, so let me jump ahead with that autograph scene. So now we're actually filming it, and it's all my merch on the tables, but it's very neat and tidy. I said, Darren, it wouldn't look like this. Every inch of the table would be covered, and it's like a flea market. You know, that's the real look of a wrestling convention. And then as I'm standing there just watching, you know, they're setting up the cameras, Darren gets this smirk and he looks at me and he goes, Evan, come here. And I go, yeah. And he goes, I want you to walk around all the tables, walk up to Mickey last, ask him for an autograph and a Polaroid. Okay. So all of a sudden I'm an actor. I've never acted in my life. Yeah. So Mickey walks over to me, whispers in my ear. He says, just improv it. He thinks I'm an actor. So I do exactly what Darren says, and I'm nervous. I mean, so I walk up to Manny Yarborough, who was actually a friend, start talking to him. And I walked up to Mickey last, and the whole time I'm thinking, what do I say? And I think, well, what would I say to a wrestling legend? And I go, I loved you as a kid. I saw you at Madison Square Garden. Can I have your autograph? He looks at me and he goes, what's your name? And now I'm thinking again. I go, Evan. And it dawns on me how surreal this is. I'm playing myself in a fictional movie. How utterly surreal this is. And jump ahead. So that Aronofsky, after the shot is done, he runs over to me, starts pounding me on the chest, goes, that was great. That was great because I looked nervous. I looked like a starstruck fan. It's 125 people there, these monstrous cameras in my face. I'm not an actor. So Johnny Valiant, after it was all done, he says to me, you know, your hand was shaking a little. Because I was legitimately, I'm not an actor. So it rang true. And that's what Aronofsky loves, when it rings true, when it has heart and feeling. So jump ahead with that scene again. Now it's a year or so later. We're at the Lincoln Center New York Film Festival, one of the most prestigious film festivals in the world. It's the first time I've seen the movie. I don't know if I'm on the cutting room floor or whatnot. I'm with my girlfriend, who's now my wife, and the scene comes on. She looks at the screen. She looks at me. She looks at the screen. She looks at me. She goes, that's you. And it was just surreal. And later that night, when Mickey does the scene where he says to his daughter, I'm just a broken down piece of meat, I look around and everybody's crying. They're crying. And I knew right then and there, I go, it works. The film works. And that's 7 years of meetings and, you know, fundraising and casting. And I put together 5 or 6 casting calls, you know, So the blood, sweat, and tears that went into this, am I allowed to curse on your show?
I can edit it out. I'll bleep it.
Okay. So we're at the wrap party. The film is done. It's in the can. And I'll never forget, Aronofsky does this speech. And again, from the heart, emotional. He goes, I don't know what the F we have, but we have something. We have something. Because it was from the heart. It was real. So getting back to what you said earlier, guys like Jim Cornette, and I love Cornette. I'm a Midnight Express mark, right. My all-time favorite tag team. Yeah. Cornette says we don't all end up in trailer parks. I understand that. But, you know, Darren, first of all, leans dark. His films are all dark. And some guys do end up badly.
Right.
We did a documentary, 350 Days. There were 36 legends in it. Bret Hart ended up well. Nikolai ended up well. But Paul Orndorff needed a GoFundMe at the end. Kamala needed a GoFundMe to save his house. WWF, WWE didn't take care of their legends like they should have. There was no health insurance, no benefits, Johnny Valiant never broke $100,000. Number one tag team in the world, okay? This is what the fans who do the... Maybe. They all blew fortunes on Wine Women, a song. They have no clue. A lot of these guys never made big money,
right.
Never were taken care of after working 300 plus days a year. Our movie's called 350 Days because the NWA champs wrestled literally 350 days, okay? Bret Hart, who's in our film, wrestled 330. Greg Valentine, who's in our film, wrestled 320. It's not... How did these guys not have pensions and 401ks and health benefits? What more do you have to be an employee than to work 320, 330, 350 days? Come on.
Right. I'm actually amazed Greg Valentine only, and I use air quotes, only worked 320 days. I would have guessed more. If you would have asked.
That's plenty.
Right.
That's plenty.
Oh, I'm not saying it's little, but for the kind of schedule he worked, Mid-Atlantic and WWE back in the 80s, I would have guessed more.
And then what the fans don't understand is if they got hurt, they worked in pain. You know, they needed painkillers. They needed something because they were scared of losing their spot. There was no union.
Right.
You know, you're hurt. You don't show up for a couple of weeks, a couple of months. You're done.
Right.
Your push is over. Your spot is gone. They don't understand this.
Right.
And it's like blaming the victim.
Wrestling,
and,
wrestling is a very libertarian occupation.
Even mid-80s, when the big money came in, quote-unquote big money,
right.
You know, these main event guys were making $400,000,
right.
Whatever. You know, do the math. They're working the same arenas as Paul McCartney and Rod Stewart and people. You know, these guys weren't working for four figures a night. These guys were working, you know, for six figures a night.
Right.
It's a whole different, you know, these guys never got what they should have gotten.
Evan Ginsberg's new book, Wrestling Rings, Blackboards, and Movie Sets, available right now on Amazon. Be sure to check it out. Stand by, a little bit more coming up. Jim Valley, Wrestling Observer Live. It's Jim Valley. It's Wrestling Observer Live. And I hope you've enjoyed the show with Evan Ginsberg. New book, Wrestling Rings, Blackboards, and Movie Sets. You can find it on Amazon, but talking with Evan, we've talked a lot of old school today, obviously, but what I love about him is he's not jaded. Evan, you also love, like, Kenny Omega, for example.
I love Omega. He's one of my favorites out there today, and I actually use the old adage, which some of the kids won't even know. If you don't appreciate an Ospreay or a Kenny Omega, it's like casting pearls to swine. They don't get it. It's over their heads. They just don't get it. If you toss out the word spot monkey and you don't want to enjoy it or you don't even watch it, When Ospreay wrestled Omega not all that long ago, it's art. It's wrestling elevated to art.
All right. We have got so much more to cover with Evan Ginsberg. I hope you understand. Do you see why we talked for like 2 hours? I expected enough to do one show. I've got like a mini series worth of time with Evan Ginsberg. I knew I would enjoy it. I didn't realize I would enjoy it as much as I did. So be sure to check out his new book, Wrestling Rings, Blackboards, and Movie Sets. It was just released in early January of 2025. You can find it on Amazon. Go check it out. I hope you've loved this conversation as much as I have, because I have loved this. So next week, I will not be here either, but we will get even more in-depth. Talk about more old school, more new school, more everything with author, producer, agent, host, so much more. Check out Evan Ginsberg. I have loved this. I hope you have too. I will talk to you live in 2 weeks, but we'll be back with a new show recorded with Evan next week. All right. Have a great week. I'll talk to you soon. Jim Valley, Wrestling Observer, live.